This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a couple of history lessons for you today on this Independence Day edition of Trumpet Hour. This is the anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, 242 years ago today in America. We celebrate with fireworks and backyard cookouts, but I suppose most Americans don't necessarily give a whole lot of thought to what we're really celebrating. So we're going to start the show today by looking at the inspiration for the Declaration. This is a marvelous speech that American President Calvin Coolidge gave about it back in 1926. In our second segment, July 1st through 3rd in 1863 was the Battle of Gettysburg, the deadliest battle of the American Civil War. Well, today we seem to be on the cusp of a second Civil War. We're hearing more and more calls for revolution in the United States. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this and what Bible prophecy says about it. Also, my last word at the end of the program is about the vital importance of history to our survival. And one last thing, in our third segment, we'll take a little different course and we'll talk about aging and frailty. Naturally, as we age, we get weaker, and studies show 17.1 million people in America are chronically weak to the point that they can't lift a 10-pound bag of groceries or walk a quarter mile. We'll talk with personal trainer Jörg Mardian about what you can do to avoid being in that number. It's quite encouraging to realize how much there is you can do. Now, we'll start by talking about the Declaration of Independence. It's the 4th of July, Independence Day in America. The date of the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, 242 years ago today. In America, we celebrate with fireworks and backyard cookouts. I suppose most Americans don't necessarily give a whole lot of thought to what we're really celebrating on this day. But if you want to read a stirring explanation of the principles of America's Declaration of Independence, read Calvin Coolidge. On this date in 1926, 92 years ago, it was the 150th anniversary of the Declaration's signing. And U.S. President Calvin Coolidge gave a speech celebrating the document. This was shortly after the Woodrow Wilson presidency that had driven the progressive agenda dramatically forward in American politics. And Coolidge rejected progressivism. And he used this occasion, July 4th, 1926, and this speech to answer the progressive movement with a robust defense of America's founding principles. And really, this is a time when we need to take a good look at this document. With all of the partisanship, all of the political turbulence, the bewildering social change, this is a perspective that every American needs to remember. And I think anyone who has any interest in America's founding principles would take a lot from this. Coolidge said, it's wonderful to witness the birth of a new nation. And he said, it is to pay our tribute of reverence and respect to those who participated in such a mighty event that we annually observe the 4th day of July. After 150 years, America had showed itself to be really stable, and time had proved, Coolidge said, the value of our institutions and their dependability as rules for the regulation of human conduct and the advancement of civilization. So the 4th of July is meant to reaffirm and reestablish those old theories and principles which time and the unerring logic of events have demonstrated to be sound. Amid all the clash of conflicting interests, amid all the welter of partisan politics, every American can turn for solace and consolation to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States with the assurance and confidence that those two great charters of freedom and justice remain firm and unshaken. 92 years later, that might not be so much the case, but there is just a whole lot about those documents that we can learn from and really be thankful for. But President Coolidge talked about the spirit of the American Revolution. He said, a new civilization had come, a new spirit had arisen on this side of the Atlantic, more advanced and more developed in its regard for the rights of the individual than that which characterized the old world. A separate establishment was ultimately inevitable. It had been decreed by the very laws of human nature. Man everywhere has an unconquerable desire to be the master of his own destiny. The American Revolution represented the informed and mature convictions of a great mass of independent, liberty-loving, God-fearing people who knew their rights and possessed the courage to dare to maintain them. So we naturally think of revolution as rebellion, but Coolidge, in this speech, he argues convincingly that this was not what motivated the American Revolution. He said, the Declaration of Independence was the result of the seasoned and deliberate thought of the dominant portion of the people of the colonies. It had about it nothing of the lawless and disordered nature of a riotous insurrection. It was maintained on a plane which rises above the ordinary conception of rebellion. It was in no sense a radical movement, but took on the dignity of a resistance to illegal usurpations. It was conservative and represented the action of the colonists to maintain their constitutional rights, which from time immemorial had been guaranteed to them under the law of the land. And if you read the Declaration of Independence, you see this enumeration of violations that had been taking place under the English king that they drew attention to. But it's mostly with the preamble of the Declaration of Independence that Coolidge is concerned, and he's talking about the principles that it articulated. The Declaration speaks about principles that are broader than just the secession of one people from another, and there's something about it, Coolidge said, that has ever since caused it to be regarded as one of the great charters that not only was to liberate America, but was everywhere to ennoble humanity. It was not because it was proposed to establish a new nation, but because it was proposed to establish a nation on new principles that July 4th, 1776 has come to be regarded as one of the greatest days in history. The preamble of the Declaration lays out three of these principles, and this is the way Coolidge listed them. The doctrine that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, and that therefore the source of the just powers of government must be derived from the consent of the governed. Now, these ideas had been around for millennia in various forms, but as Coolidge said, they had never been assembled before and declared in such a combination. But he said what made this so extraordinary was the fact that this ideal, these ideals were actually put into action with, he said, a duly authorized and constituted representative public body in its sovereign capacity, supported by the force of general opinion and by the armies of Washington already in the field. It was an assertion that a people had arisen determined to make every necessary sacrifice for the support of these truths, and by their practical application bring the War of Independence to a successful conclusion and adopt the Constitution of the United States with all that it has meant to civilization. So it wasn't just our ideas that were behind the Declaration. They really wanted to put this into action in this new nation, a very blessed nation, a nation with so much natural wealth and resources, and really quite an extraordinary people who had made their way over to live in the New World. Now, of all those principles, the one really unique to America was the doctrine of equality. Other nations had decided that, well, the people should choose their own rulers. Other nations had articulated what they considered to be inalienable rights. But equality, Coolidge said, had not before appeared as an official political declaration of any nation. It was profoundly revolutionary. It is one of the cornerstones of American institutions. And where did that idea come from? Where did the understanding come from that all men are created equal? Well, in this speech, Coolidge showed how it came from America's religion. He tracks that idea through the colonial era churches and the teachings of early American ministers. He quotes as far back as 1710, early in the 18th century, an influential preacher named John Wise, who wrote, "Every man must be acknowledged equal to every man." And the forceful preaching of the men espousing this ideal, he said, reached the neighborhood of Thomas Jefferson, who acknowledged that his best ideas of democracy had been secured at church meetings. When we take all these circumstances into consideration, Coolidge said, it is but natural that the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence should open with a reference to nature's God, and should close in the final paragraphs with an appeal to the supreme judge of the world and an assertion of the firm reliance on divine providence. Coming from these sources, having as it did this background, it is no wonder that Samuel Adams could say, "The people seem to recognize this resolution as though it were a decree promulgated from heaven." No one can examine this record and escape the conclusion that in its great outline of its principles, the Declaration was the result of the religious teachings of the preceding period. These principles are found in the texts, the sermons, and the writings of the early colonial clergy, who were earnestly undertaking to instruct their congregations in the great mystery of how to live. They preached equality because they believed in the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. They justified freedom by the text that we are all created in the divine image. Now, that is really a remarkable truth. It's so easy to take for granted the blessing of living in a country that established it as a cornerstone principle and that has striven ever since, unlike any other people in history, to live up to that ideal. America's founders, they used that belief in equality as justification for establishing government by the people. Now, anyone knowledgeable in the Bible can recognize that democratic, ground-up self-government is very different from the biblical model of government. And when you look at the nation today, the problems that are associated with that form of government that the founders established, they are becoming clearer all the time. But still, that uncommon and, as Coolidge described it, revolutionary ideal of each person being equal and endowed with God-given rights, the way that the Declaration establishes that, it is actually biblical. It is beautiful. It is extraordinarily powerful. Coolidge continued, "In those days, such doctrines would scarcely have been permitted to flourish and spread in any other country. This was the purpose which the founders cherished. In order that they might have freedom to express these thoughts and opportunity to put them into action, whole congregations with their pastors had migrated to the colonies. These great truths were in the air that our peoples breathed. Whatever else we may say of it, the Declaration of Independence was profoundly American." Now then, Coolidge drew some important conclusions from these facts, and we would all do well to remember these. If we forget this history, we lose sight of these foundational principles, we're going to really experience problems. As Coolidge said, "A spring will cease to flow if its source be dried up. A tree will wither if its roots be destroyed." In its main features, the Declaration of Independence is a great spiritual document. It is a declaration not of material, but of spiritual conceptions, equality, liberty, popular sovereignty, the rights of man. These are not elements which we can see and touch. They are ideals. They have their source and their roots in the religious convictions. Unless the faith of the American people in these religious convictions is to endure, the principles of our declaration will perish. We cannot continue to enjoy the result if we neglect and abandon the cause. Of course, this is exactly what America is witnessing today. These religious convictions have been replaced with new principles of morality, tolerating lawlessness, demanding government welfare, restricting freedoms in the name of enforcing liberal orthodoxy. And this is going to create untold problems. Coolidge said, "We are too prone to overlook another conclusion. Governments do not make ideals, but ideals make governments." This is both historically and logically true. Of course, the government can help to sustain ideals and create institutions through which they can be the better observed. But their source, by their very nature, is in the people. The people have to bear their own responsibilities. There is no method by which that burden can be shifted to the government. It is not the enactment, but the observance of laws that creates the character of a nation. And Coolidge said this about the Declaration: "There is a finality that is exceedingly restful. It is often asserted that the world has made a great deal of progress since 1776. That we've had new thoughts and new experiences, which has given us a great advantage over the people of that day, and that we may therefore well discard their conclusions for something more modern. But that reasoning cannot be applied to this great charter. If all men are created equal, that is final. If they are endowed with inalienable rights, that is final. If governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, that is final. No advance, no progress can be made beyond these propositions. If anyone wishes to deny their truth or their soundness, the only direction in which he can proceed historically is not forward, but backward, toward the time when there was no equality, no rights of the individual, no rule of the people. Those who wish to proceed in that direction cannot lay claim to progress. They are reactionary. Their ideas are not more modern, but more ancient than those of the revolutionary fathers." It's quite a statement. And so much of what we see today really does represent a step backward. Not all change is progress. We would do well to cherish the finality of these principles established at our founding, to conserve them, to preserve them. Toward the end of his speech, Coolidge made these conclusions: "Under a system of popular government, there will always be those who seek for political preferment by clamoring for reform. While there is very little of this which is not sincere, there is a large portion that is not well informed. In my opinion, very little of just criticism can attach to the theories and principles of our institutions. There is far more danger of harm than there is hope of good in any radical changes. We do need a better understanding and comprehension of them and a better knowledge of the foundations of government in general. Our forefathers came to certain conclusions and decided upon certain courses of action which have been a great blessing to the world. Before we can understand their conclusions, we must go back and review the course which they followed. We must think the thoughts which they thought. Their intellectual life centered around the meeting house. They were intent upon religious worship. While there were always among them men of deep learning, and later those who had comparatively large possessions, the mind of the people was not so much engrossed in how much they knew or how much they had as in how they were going to live. While scantily provided with other literature, there was a wide acquaintance with the scriptures. Over a period as great as that which measures the existence of our independence, they were subject to this discipline not only in their religious life and educational training, but also in their political thought. They were a people who came under the influence of a great spiritual development and acquired a great moral power. No other theory is adequate to explain or comprehend the Declaration of Independence. It is the product of the spiritual insight of the people. And then President Coolidge came to this conclusion, which we would do well to consider deeply. It wasn't even a century ago, just about three generations, when an American president articulated this kind of moral clarity and provided this kind of moral leadership. He said this: "We live in an age of science and of abounding accumulation of material things. These did not create our declaration. Our declaration created them. The things of the spirit come first. Unless we cling to that, all our material prosperity, overwhelming though it may appear, will turn to a barren scepter in our grasp. If we are to maintain the great heritage which has been bequeathed to us, we must be like-minded as the fathers who created it. We must not sink into a pagan materialism. We must cultivate the reverence which they had for the things that are holy. We must follow the spiritual and moral leadership which they showed. We must keep replenished that they may glow with a more compelling flame, the altar fires before which they worshiped."
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
About 77 years after the end of the Revolutionary War, America experienced the Civil War. There are signs today that the nation is about to experience a second Civil War, as we'll hear now in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
"155 years ago yesterday, on July 3rd of 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg came to an end. It was the largest battle ever fought on the American continent, and it ended with a decisive victory for the Union. That victory marked a turning point in the American Civil War. It gave the North a strategic upper hand and enough momentum so that it would soon go on to defeat the South. The Union was preserved. The people of America, for the most part, accepted a common vision for the nation. And the United States became prosperous and powerful. The country went on to play a vital role in defeating imperialist powers in both world wars. And then the U.S. went on to oversee an era of relative peace for billions of people. But in recent years, political polarization is once again fracturing the United States. And since the election of President Donald Trump in 2016, the outrage of America's radical left has reached a fever pitch. Just within the last week, we've seen all kinds of vitriol unleashed. Here's a clip from California Congresswoman Maxine Waters speaking on June 23rd, and she's publicly calling for leftists to harass and intimidate not just President Trump, but also his administration, for their role in the detention of the children of illegal immigrants.
"If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome."
Those statements from Maxine Waters came just a day after White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had been asked to leave a Virginia restaurant just because she works for the president. Waters was endorsing that harassment and calling for it to be replicated and intensified across the country. Her calls to action kicked off a national firestorm, with some officials on both sides of the political aisle calling for reconsideration of these kinds of calls for uncivility. But Waters was not swayed. In a subsequent interview with MSNBC, she doubled down on her stance, saying Trump and his team should be, quote, absolutely harassed until they decide to change their minds. A couple of days later, on June 28th, Hillary Clinton, who lost the 2016 presidential race to Trump, was asked about the uncivil nature of the calls to action that Waters and other radical leftists are making. Clinton said, "Oh, give me a break. Resolve and strength are needed to resist the president." Last Thursday, former President Barack Obama warned the crowd at a Democratic National Committee fundraiser that the U.S. is on the brink. Regarding the state of the American leadership, Obama said, quote, "You are right to be concerned." But concern is not enough for the radical leftist filmmaker Michael Moore. He appeared on The Late Show on June 28th, and after calling President Trump the devil, he asked, "When are people going to get off the couch and rise up?" The only way we're going to stop this is eventually we're all going to have to put our bodies on the line. You're going to have to be willing to do this. Those are calls to action, calls to rise up. And over the weekend, tens of thousands of people across the United States responded to all that incendiary rhetoric. There were anti-Trump protests held in more than 700 cities in all 50 states. These resulted in numerous arrests. And the main message for many of the protesters is that America's borders need to be left open. Maybe this current bout of leftist outrage will dissipate since Trump has signed an executive order to end the policy of separating families. But the general bitter division remains, and huge numbers of Americans feel that it will soon lead to a major internal conflict. A Rasmussen survey published this week said almost one-third of Americans think another civil war could break out in the U.S. in the next 5 years, and only 29% said they felt such a scenario was not at all likely. A more detailed breakdown of the poll results showed that 44% of African Americans believe a civil war will occur within 5 years, while 28% of white Americans and 36% of other minority voters agree. The sobering reality is that these poll respondents are right. In August of last year, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said, quote, "The bitter division in America today is leading to another civil war that will be 10,000 times worse than the first one," end quote. In that article, Mr. Fleury examined a statement that Jesus Christ made during his ministry on earth. It's recorded in Matthew 12:25, and Christ said, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand." And of course, Abraham Lincoln famously quoted those words in the context of the Civil War. And Mr. Fleury goes on to talk about the way the stage is now set for another civil war, because the American House is divided once again. Mr. Fleury said, quote, "Republicans and Democrats are divided like no time before. The radical left is stirring up so many problems in America. Some on the radical left believe they are bringing down President Donald Trump, but are they instead bringing down America itself? And what will be the results of an America that collapses in civil war once again?" Well, in November of last year, Mr. Fleury answered that. He said the second American Civil War would result in an end to the era of relative peace that the U.S. has maintained on the global stage for the last several decades. He said, quote, "How serious is this issue? The first Civil War cost almost as many American lives as all other American wars combined, but another eruption of violence between Americans would be far worse. If the country plunges into infighting, many foreign nations will be ready to pounce. America is the wealthiest nation in history. If it continues to destroy itself, nations like China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and others will destroy whatever the Civil War doesn't as they vie for the loot. The American superpower will become history, and a third world war with multiple nuclear powers will follow. The Trumpet and before us, Herbert W. Armstrong, have warned of a World War III for over 80 years. This war is prophesied in your Bible. America's division is hastening the fulfillment of what God forecast thousands of years ago." So this is a really sobering reality. By continuously stoking the flames of discontent, radical leftists are playing with fire. Right now, that fire is mostly confined to the halls of academia and to the media and to other enclaves of leftism. But Mr. Fleury's analysis is based on Bible prophecy, and it says those flames will spread. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 7 describes the near future of the United States, saying, "Your country is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, your land, strangers devour it in your presence, and it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers." So it's clear that God is pleading with the American people to hear his warning. And there is hope in this warning message, and there is a way of escape from the coming civil war. There's a way to be spared from the carnage and suffering that's looming on the horizon. Mr. Fleury discusses this hope and this path of escape in an episode of The Key of David that was broadcast on August 24th of last year. And here's what he says.
Verse 14, "And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle." God's going to protect his people that do repent of their national sins and all other sins. And he's going to protect them. He'd protect everybody if they'd let him, but they won't repent. And it goes on to say that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time or 3.5 years from the face of the serpent. That's what your Bible says. And yet God wants to protect us. He wants to protect us. We don't have to experience it. That's an acutely painful way to learn a lesson. It's just a way we should not have to learn it. And God says, "I want you to learn from your past history. And more importantly than that, I want you to learn from what Christ says, and he will bring you peace and joy and happiness as you've never seen it before."
So there are some very serious divisions in the United States today. Both history and prophecy agree that they will deepen and lead to major conflict. But it's clear that there is a way of escape, and that there is cause for hope, and that we can be protected and have true, lasting peace and joy in our lives.
Thank you, Jeremiah. You know, it really feels like we've seen a remarkable unmasking of the real nature of the left just in the last few years especially. Because they're obviously commonly use language of tolerance and freedom and justice, and but there's a strong link between liberalism and authoritarianism, and here you have these folks who there's no attempt to try to persuade people to their side; they're just using bully tactics. I just find it quite interesting to see how it seems the real nature of it is just becoming clearer and clearer.
That's right. And what's interesting about this latest round of vitriol and all of this rhetoric about, you know, pushing back even physically against Trump and his cabinet is that it's over immigration policies that Hillary Clinton herself and even Barack Obama, these kinds of policies are not new to the Trump administration, but it's just something that they've decided to pounce on since he's in power. So it really is an unmasking, as you said. It's not a sincere grievance so much as it's just a desire to see the nation weakened and brought down and maybe collapsed.
Yeah. It's a power play, really. It's not a principled stand. I mean, I think Stephen Fleury brought that out really well in his Trumpet Daily last week when he's looking at all of these signs that are saying, you know, families belong together, and you know, how can you possibly break up the family? This from the same people who have just done more to separate and divide families than anything for quite a few decades now. Suddenly family is sacrosanct and it can't be messed with. But you do see, I mean, you did a good job of just showing how those the statements that they're making here really are leading to violence. And you can see that because there is no what other solution is there? Like, they're past the point of discussing these things, and they're at least to the point where they're openly advocating for just physical violence. Where else can that lead to?
That's right. They say, you know, the time for words is over. And especially those statements from Michael Moore are just chilling. You know, and he says, it's time to rise up, get off your couch. You need to be ready to put your body in harm's way if need be in order to, you know, really bring about an overthrow of the existing order. So if their goals are to be accomplished, you're exactly right. It could only end in, you know, in some kind of serious conflict.
So that biblical principle you mentioned, the house divided cannot stand, really, I think people just do not recognize how serious the danger is in what they're advocating here. But you put it together with those other prophecies, and especially America's cities falling into violence, and you really do get a sense of where this is leading. We appreciate you bringing that to us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about America's poisonous political environment leading to a new civil war. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief yesterday. This is a daily email brief that we send out to anyone who wants it. It's absolutely free. You can subscribe to that and get that every day. Or you can just go to thetrumpet.com and read this article that he's written. What's the title of that article, Jeremiah?
Is a Second Civil War Coming to America?
Yeah. So go to thetrumpet.com and check it out. And thanks for your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Naturally, as we age, we get weaker unless we do something to prevent it. But many people don't do anything to prevent it. And studies show 17.1 million Americans are chronically weak to the point they can't lift a 10-pound sack of groceries or walk a quarter mile. So this is a real problem and a growing body of inactive and physically weakened people. What can you do to avoid becoming one of them? To talk about this, we have personal trainer Jorg Mardian via Skype from his office in British Columbia. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine.
So I would imagine that this would be very relevant information for a lot of people out there. 17.1 million people is a lot of people, and some of them may be listening to this program. I have a pretty good idea of what we're talking about when we say frailty, but maybe you could define it the way you look at it.
Absolutely. It's really a symptom where you get an increased risk of poor health outcomes. So as we age, we simply become weaker and we get more sick, and it includes a risk of, say, falling or disability. You could end up in a hospital, or you could even die. I mean, mm-hmm. We know that people who fall at a certain age, their risk of dying is at least 50% greater. So it's really a decline in the function of the body. So the function, it just goes downhill after certain ages, right? And then you see all these risks appear. They're really predictors of ill health and early death. That's what that is. So the more frail we are, the faster we slide towards that chasm.
Essentially, when you're frail, the fall that you would have bounced back from when you were younger, or maybe even that bug that you get, or something doesn't go quite right, the effect that it has is a lot more devastating just because of a generally weakened state that you're in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's really catastrophic on the body. I mean, you just have this state where you don't have a lot of strength. You can have a lot of weight loss with frailty as well. Mm. You certainly have limited physical ability or activities, and your endurance and fatigue are down, and all these just lead you downhill. You know, there's, I think it's up to 12% of Americans age 65 and older are considered frail. And once you go up from there, that risk increases. So I think they say you have from 1 in 25 people between the ages of 65 and 74. And after that, it goes to 1 in 4.
Wow. So that decade takes its toll on you.
Oh, absolutely. Those numbers are concerning. If you're looking at it as, say, you have a family member that's in that condition, because you have, your body just has increased risk of infections, of illness, of falls, of disabilities, and you know it's coming if you don't have some kind of intervention.
Yeah. So intervention, how is it that you can help your body to resist, reduce that frailty, increase your strength, and increase your, I guess, your resilience to those incidents that might happen that would tend to hurt you if you weren't so robustly healthy?
Right. And see, this is the thing about frailty. It's mostly preventable. So just to give you an introduction to it, between the ages of 0 and 30, we're growing muscle.
Yeah.
We just have a lot of muscle. But after that, that's where the problems begin. And then you
at
start
age 30, the problems begin at age 30.
Yes. According to science.
A lot sooner than people would tend to think. It seems like a lot of people's, a lot of people are becoming more frail and not really thinking too much about it, or maybe that decline is gradual enough that you're not really paying attention, and then one day something happens where you think, wow, I suddenly feel kind of old.
Well, I truly believe it's a modern phenomenon, because if you're active at 30 is still very young. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a prime of life. You should be up there just doing everything you're able to do if you're active and strong. I believe that they're talking about people in today's society, because we're only going back, you know, really with these statistics, 100 years. But if you go back to farm society, it wasn't like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, myself, I have a father-in-law who's 80 plus, and he looks, you know, 60.
Mm-hmm.
You'd never know. I mean, he's just robust. He works hard.
Right.
So, I mean, they say it's an age-related thing, but I think you can slow that down quite dramatically. So after the age of 30, they say you lose about 3 to 5% of your muscle mass each decade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so which is fairly significant. I mean, you would notice that.
You're talking about in a state of inactivity. If a 30-year-old doesn't really do anything to tax his muscles, by the time he's 40, he's lost 3 to 5% of his muscle mass.
That would be inactive, yes.
Yep.
There's just no way, from all indications that I've seen myself and what I've studied and the people I see who are active, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
You do see some decline, but it's radically less.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for myself, I know just, you know, anecdotally, I was strong as a bull decades ago. I wouldn't consider myself quite as strong, but I haven't noticed any loss of spring in my step.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still going strong today because I'm in that business and I continue to take care of my health.
And how old are you now, Jorg?
I'm in my early 50s.
Okay. So early 50s, this would be, you know, for someone who's stayed inactive, this would be like well into the period of decline.
That's what they would say, yes. Now, you'll notice a different, I mean, every decade you do notice a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of we are getting older. I mean, it's not going to be as robust as when you're 25. Nothing is ever as good as when we're 25.
Yeah.
You know, strength-wise and bodily vigor-wise. But we shouldn't lose it dramatically.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we should be able to keep up pretty good in a good state if we're active. And that's important because muscle matters. And I tell everyone that if you don't have that muscle, you lose your strength and mobility.
Yeah.
And for myself, I still carry a lot of strength and mobility because I practice it daily, daily, consistently, right?
Okay. So I like that muscle matters. And I think actually, just in my own experience, it seems like strength is really a major component of quality of life, particularly as you age. That that if a person can remain strong, you're doing a lot to stave off that frailty that you're talking about. But it does require effort. It does take work. I just want to ask, and maybe whether you answer this right now or before we finish, you're in the business, you're in this regularly, but we still want solutions for the person who, you know, isn't a fitness trainer, still wants to be able to do these things that are going to help them to remain strong as they age.
Right. So all exercise matters. I mean, we're not saying that there's exercise. There's just exercise that's more efficient. Mm-hmm. That's what I've found over the years of doing this. And it's not a complicated formula. It really isn't. It's just not embraced. Mm-hmm. So when we get to people who get near retirement age, that's what they think about: retiring, traveling, you know. But the worst thing you can do is just to sit. So now the basic amount of exercise we're supposed to do, you know, according to the American College of Sports Medicine, is 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobics at least. So it is important to get your heart rate up. But strength training should be included at least 2 to 4 times a week. Hmm. Because you have to include the large muscle groups to be able to stay vigorous, mm-hmm. to stay walking, to be able to get in and up and down from a chair. We find that people in their 60s already are having trouble getting up 4 or 5 times out of a chair. Mm-hmm. You know, once sometimes is a struggle for them. So that's the gold standard now for treatment for frailty: strength training or resistance training exercises for all the large muscle groups to be able to continue with that quality of life. And for myself, for my clients, I have clients from between 45 and 95. Mm. And I treat them all the same, except you do it to within their ability.
Yeah.
Of course. So you cannot ask somebody that's, you know, between 65 and 85 to do the same as somebody decades younger. But we're finding now that strength training isn't all about bulging muscles. You know, that's sort of an antiquated look at it. It's all about a quality of life. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at somebody, we're saying, look, there's so many health outcomes that's related to strength training. You know, and we're also finding that you don't have to strength train hard your maximum weights. What you need to do is to do a lot of repetitions and stimulate that muscle to failure. And they're finding that's the key as we age, to make sure that we stimulate the muscle to failure. Hmm. and make sure that we have a proper strength training program. And sometimes that requires getting the help of a professional.
Okay, well, let's get to specifics and practical steps that someone could take, because I feel like a lot of people are intimidated by the idea of strength training. You know, like you said, you get the image in mind of the guy with the barbell with tons of plates on each side. When you're dealing with seniors, and there may be, you know, a lot of seniors don't even have, say, they wouldn't have the funds to hire a personal trainer. What sort of steps might they be able to take that would be practical that they could do? Maybe, I don't know, are there things they can even do in their own home?
Oh, absolutely. The key is to maybe, if you don't have the funds for a personal trainer, or you can always join, say, a group class for a little bit to get an idea of how to move. Mm. Community center, they have free classes. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure that there's somebody there. Some people have joint issues or mobility or injuries. They really do need somebody around. That's just a fact. And so it's important that they have some oversight. But if the funds aren't available, there's always the community centers, the YMCAs, and most classes they aren't a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But let's say you just want to learn the exercises. You might just want to join a group for, say, 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Note the exercises, note the type of weights that they use and the equipment, and which is really inexpensive, and then just go and jot those on a piece of paper and go home and start doing them. But the key is form. Mm-hmm. Somebody starts doing an exercise and they get the wrong form, then you have a sore back, and then, of course, you're going to get discouraged.
Yeah.
Right.
So you go to the class or you get some kind of training where you can learn how do I do these movements safely, maybe put a little bit of money into some equipment. And like what equipment would you be talking about?
A pair of dumbbells, say a small weighted ball mm-hmm. is really all you need. Mm-hmm. Say you might want a stepper that you can step up and down on. I'm talking about a very basic component program.
Yep.
If you're more robust, you can grab yourself a barbell or something heavier, you know, that you can work with. As long as you're able to do the large muscle groups that keep you walking, that's important. And I just want to say that as a personal trainer, what I try to do is I will give somebody one lesson and I'll give them a program that can last them half a year, 6-8 months, just by scaling it.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I'm sure that that person is moving properly, I will let them go home and do it themselves.
Yeah.
But that's the key, making sure that movement is proper, because it can actually, that's where it comes in. And then they blame the exercise as the exercise itself doing it, when it's really the form that they're doing wrong.
Yeah. Well, I've heard it said that the best thing that you can do is good movement well. The maybe less safe thing that you can do is to do good movement poorly. But the least safe thing you can do is not move, no movement whatsoever. So it's definitely good advice to get moving and try to stave off some of that frailty that tends to come inevitably as we age. Hopefully that can be a good motivator for some folks out there. Are there any online resources that you might refer people to if there was anything that would help get them started?
Well, I do have an article that I'm writing up on it, so I could include all of that in there if
okay.
we do post it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've been talking with personal trainer Jörg Mardian about how to retain and build strength in old age. He's working on an article about this subject for thetrumpet.com. We'll try to make sure that we include some links in there that would be useful to the reader. But you can check that out at thetrumpet.com. Jörg, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
The value of history is understood less and less in our world. It's an easy subject to underestimate, but the reality that is becoming clearer and clearer to me personally, the more I study it, is that knowing history is vital to a people's survival. Last summer, I took my family to our campus in Edstone, England, to participate in our youth summer camp there. And during the camp, the whole group took a bus into London. And we had two main stops on our trip, the British Museum and the Churchill War Rooms. Both of these places were rich in crucial history. And I was really thrilled that we were able to create an experience like that to help these young people forge stronger connections with the past. At the British Museum, we saw several artifacts that spanned millennia, proving the veracity of the history contained in the Bible. These teenagers, they could see the savage brutality of the Assyrian people displayed on the Lachish reliefs. These are preserved from over 2,700 years ago. They could see the Taylor Prism with its account by King Sennacherib of besieging Jerusalem. And that full story is told in the biblical books of Chronicles and Isaiah. They could see the Cyrus Cylinder. This is 2,500 years old, bringing to life the history of Cyrus, this Persian king who set captive Jews free in order to rebuild Jerusalem. These are just a few of the many displays showing all this history, the wealth, the inventiveness, the precision, the craftsmanship, the social life, the paganism, the humanness of these bygone generations from all over the world. Every nook and cranny in this museum had curiosities and mysteries and lessons from the past.
The Churchill War Rooms, these are the bunkers that are tucked under Whitehall Street that served as Britain's command center during World War II, and they've been converted since then into an outstanding museum. It made the history of Britain's finest hour wonderfully vivid. We got a sense of the destructiveness of the German Blitz and the solidarity of the Londoners cheerfully accepting the privation and the rallying to a mountain opposition, the night and day labor of Prime Minister Winston Churchill and his staff, and the determination and the indomitability required to vanquish the Nazis. This was all extremely valuable and very relevant history to ponder. It just happened that on the ride into the city, as we were taking this field trip, I started to read Gerald Fleury's booklet, The Book of Chronicles. And he made this statement on the very first page. This world is lost in the present. God is always challenging his people to keep the overview, to see the grand sweep, both historically and prophetically. It's so important that we have that overview. Creating connections with the past orients us, and it stabilizes us. It gives us specific lessons that can help us in our decision-making, both individually and nationally. It supplies our memory as a people, as well as our understanding of and our appreciation for personal and national character. It helps us and fortifies us to face hardships with resolution. It gives us a realistic sense of just how cruel human nature can be, the magnitude of the effort that is needed in order to conquer human nature. And it's also extremely prophetic, since history tends to play out in repetitive cycles. The lessons are many, and they are invaluable. Yet in our world today, history is being erased, rewritten, neglected, forgotten. In our universities, fewer and fewer undergraduates are taking history classes. Fewer colleges are insisting or mandating that they do. Fewer students are graduating with history degrees. History instructors are moving away from classic history and toward more specialized and suspect classes, like Harvard has a class on emotions in history, Yale in indigenous religious history, Stanford has a class called Mad Women, the history of women and mental illness in the U.S. What sort of lessons will that history teach? Is that the kind of history that will fill our students with a sense of positive purpose? Will it inspire them to follow the best examples of their forebears, to build heroic character? Will it strengthen them for future challenges? The better you understand history, the better you can understand why our ignorance of it is so dangerous, and the more you can see why we cannot afford to get lost in the present. We must accept God's challenge to keep the overview, to see the grand sweep, both historically and prophetically. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send comments if you want to the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on the show today, Jeremiah Jacques and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from John Stuart Mill. War is an ugly thing, but not the ugliest of things. The decayed and degraded state of moral and patriotic feeling which thinks that nothing is worth war is much worse. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.